Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts, underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Thanks, Marshall. On today's program, we're taking a trip into the world of interior design. My guest today is Matthew Patrick Smythe, one of the country's most successful interior designers, whose new book, Through a Designer's Eye, explores visually what informs his work. The book's not another designer coffee table book. It's unique for two reasons. First, it presents Matthew's own splendid photography, pictures that he's taken from his own backyard here in Salisbury, Connecticut, to the streets of Mumbai, for example, with photos of the residents he's designed. And second, it's the premier presentation of his own house here in Salisbury, which he stunningly transformed from a very dreary prefab structure built in the 1970s. Welcome, Matthew.
All right, thanks, Dan.
So it seems like yesterday, but it was back almost 10 years, 2011, you had your first book called Living Traditions.
Yeah.
And that was a success. I think it went into several printings.
It did.
And when you talked for a long time about doing a second book, but you wanted to do something different. So tell us what went into the thinking of this new book and why is it different?
Well, you know, I just didn't want to do Living Traditions Part 2. I wanted something that was more unique, a little bit more updated. And a lot happened in the last 10 years with the industry, with me, the way the iPhone became part of my life, part of everybody's life, but also using the phone to take pictures. It brought me back to photography, which I had put on the back burner for 25, 30 years. So I wanted something that reflected my new interests and as well as just the way I've evolved as a person and as a designer.
Now, you mentioned you take your pictures with the iPhone, and I know that you've got a huge Instagram following, not only for your design work, but also for these photographs. Without the benefit of the book, because we're a radio program and an audio podcast, describe how, which I think is the most unique aspect of the book, how you incorporate your photographs with photographs of the residences that you've designed.
Right. So all the square photographs in the book are photographs that I took with the iPhone, not any other camera. The actual interiors were shot by three very accomplished and famous interior photographers who do that much better than I can. But so much of what we look at as a designer is subconscious. And so I really wanted to show how, you know, things, you don't near automatically have to directly respond to something and have it turn up as an end result, but it builds up in your mind. It's how you build a vocabulary as a designer. It's the way an actor would build up characters over the years. It's the way a writer would come up with situations and experiences to write about later. The same thing is with a designer. You know, you go out and you see things. It's so important to get out there. And it doesn't have to be, you know, focused. It could be just walking the streets and just taking in colors and atmosphere and different lifestyles. And that's why I've always encouraged young designers to get out there and travel. Just don't take for granted that you know what things look like. Just get out there and just walk the streets. Just take it all in.
Can you give somebody, and this will be evident as soon as anybody even randomly just picks any page out of your book, but can you describe, for an example, if we were to open up your book, on the left, let's say, there are four little square pictures of pictures that you took in your travels, and on the right side, there's a picture of a residence. Just give us an example at random about how those pictures inform the picture on the opposite side of the page.
Well, it's usually the pictures that are selected to go with the interiors are probably things that could have influenced me in the past. You know, like the pictures could have been taken years ago, but a sense of color or a sense of proportion, a shape, probably, you know, everything adds up. So these pictures were selected that don't necessarily have a direct reference to the picture opposite, but could be a subconscious reference to it that I've that I've just put on the the back of my head over the years, and it surfaces later.
In terms of composition, texture, light, color, composition.
Yes,
all exactly. Of it. You know, I'm going to recall something that you said. We were at a dinner party some years ago, and there was another colleague or several people involved in your business, interior design, at the table, and you were talking casually about what it really is. And to sum it up, you, off the top of your head, said, well, design is really theater.
Yeah.
I know you and I share this incredible passion for theater too, and we go a lot, but to the person to whom that might strike as an odd notion, explain why what you do is in many ways theater.
Well, you know, it's about dealing with everything that a set designer would deal with or a storyteller would deal with. It's about scale. It's about telling a story. It's about adding some excitement to an interior. I remember at a dinner party that there was a designer there that I had interviewed for a position in my firm years before that. I remember we were all talking about theater. It may have been the same dinner party. And he said, I don't get it. I never got that gene. I don't really like the theater. I don't really like movies. And I just thought to myself, you know, he was a very competent designer. It was all technically perfect, but there was something missing. There was a certain flair. There was a certain energy that wasn't there. And as soon as he said that, I thought that's what was wrong with why I didn't hire him. You know, I could tell right away that was wrong with the photographs I looked at. He was just missing a sense of drama, which is, I think you just have, and we're talking about drama that could be scaled up and down as necessary in interior. It doesn't have to be in your face all the time. It could be very subtle. It could be a corner of a room. It could be a coffee table that has a little bit of style to it. It doesn't, you know, you can turn up the volume with it or turn it down, but you need to have a sense of, you know, it's just as with anything, you just want something different and an edge to something. And so I think, you know, so theater has always been part of my life, you know, since I was a theater major in school. And as you know, both of us go, and when I was out before COVID, I was out four nights a week at the theater. And, you know, and I love seeing what other designers, but the good thing about theater too is it gives you a chance to see what other designers are thinking, to get into the brain of a set designer and to see how they would interpret a story. And often I go home and I think, okay, if I had that same script, would I do it the same? And I'd love to see a production that I could never think of, that I probably wouldn't have thought of, the way somebody presented it and came up with it. And it makes you think. It just, you know, moves the dialogue along in your brain, and it's, you know, it's education too.
Yeah. In case you're just joining us, the program's Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. And my guest today is Matthew Patrick Smythe, one of the country's leading designers and a resident here in Salisbury, Connecticut. And we're talking about his new book to be published September 15th, Through a Designer's Eye, A Focus on Interiors. Let's get back to you and your iPhone and picture taking and Instagram. You've got a huge following. First, identify how people can follow your photographs on Instagram, and tell us how you got into it and how you became so so facile with it to render these really, really extraordinarily beautiful images and pictures.
Thank you. Well, the Instagram page is just my name, Matthew Patrick Smythe, Smyth, and it stemmed back. You know, I first was handed a camera in high school, a senior in high school, I was on a yearbook committee, and months were going by and nothing was getting done. And I remember the vice principal said to me, it looks like you're going to have to do the yearbook. Because I was the only one that showed any interest. And he gave me the school camera. He said, go out and shoot it. And I had no idea what he was talking. I didn't know what to do. I'd never held a camera before, besides a little, you know, Polaroid or something. But so I taught myself, and with my art teacher gave me a lot of advice and tips. And the school had a darkroom, which I didn't even know. So I taught myself to do darkroom. And I actually I photographed the whole, except for the senior class, the senior pictures, the portraits, I photographed the whole yearbook. And things and then I just did a show. And so, you know, it evolved, but I always knew that one of the things that was hanging in the back of my head was photography back then was a very expensive hobby and a very expensive major in school. And I'd already, I'd gone to school as a theater major, switched to business. And then I decided, you know, I still didn't know what to do. And photography would have been great, but I knew I couldn't afford it in the long run because I wasn't going to get more money from my parents to go to school. So for another major. And luckily I just went to a dinner party, met somebody who was weaving carpets and blankets for a designer in New York, had been to that office that day and described what he saw in an interior design office. And that piqued my interest. I didn't know that was a career. I just grew up in upstate New York. That wasn't an option, interior design. And I started looking into it and did the research on the designer who they were talking about. And to make a long story short, I moved to New York. I got into FIT and it was a portfolio review, which I didn't know I had to do. But so I came to New York from upstate with a portfolio of photographs they had taken for an interior design major interview. And when I walked in, I thought it was over because I saw kids walking in with scale models and mechanical drawings. I just thought, I'm just going to be on the bus back to Middletown. Nothing's going to happen here. And when they got to my portfolio, they started looking at it and they were running their fingers around it. And I remember they called me up and they said, is this your portfolio? And I said, yes. He goes, your portfolio is very weak, but we see something in these photographs and we're going to take a chance on you. And so that my photographs got me into interior design. I mean, literally got me into school. And so I took it. I used my camera for quite a bit after that. But about 25 years ago, I just stopped. Just stopped. And then it was the iPhone. When the iPhone started happening, the iPhone and Instagram was just came at the same time for me. And when I started looking at other designers' work on Instagram, I realized that pictures weren't very good they were taking. And I thought if I'm going to post pictures, I want the pictures to be really good. And that's how it all started. I just started taking pictures. Like very little of my website is devoted to interior design. It's mostly things I see. So I built up a reputation and a following based on street scenes and landscapes and things that interest me.
And now it's incorporated in the book, which makes it so unique. I've never seen an interior design book like it before.
Well, so, you know, it's funny how the photography, it's come full circle now. It's from my interview to get into FIT, 40 years later, I come out with a book that has the photography and interior design. Exactly 40 years, because it's 40 years ago I graduated from FIT this past June. So, you know, I really feel it's come full circle. And it's something I've always wanted to do, and I didn't really know how to do it. So it worked out well. I had lunch with my editor about a year and a half ago. And she said, you know, we're just catching up. And she said, you know, I think it's time for a book. And I said, you know, I'll do a book, but I really want to have my photographs be part of this. And I don't want to shoot the interiors, but because that's a different art altogether. And, but I said, I really, if I'm going to do something, I really want to branch out and just show a little bit more range than just, you know, picking fabrics and colors. And so, we brainstormed and came up with this concept. And, then Monticelli Press luckily said, if you can get it to us by October, which was the past October, we'll get it out for September. And so last summer I jumped into it and just got it all done. I mean, I did every Thursday and Friday, but just, I worked on the books. I shot projects last summer. Thank God it was last summer, not this summer. Cause there was talk about letting it go another year. And I said, no, I really want to do it now. I really feel the timing's right. And I just jumped into it, and luckily everything worked. Judith Nassiter, who helped me write the book, she was available. She's brilliant. Doug Tershin, the art director, was available, and everything just happened. It happened really fast, but I was very happy with the results. I have no complaints.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. Before we talk about your house, which really is, I think, the most extraordinary aspect of the book, for a specific residence, although all the other things you present are lovely too. Talk about the range of kind of projects and how many residences are pictured in this book.
There's about eight residences altogether, eight or nine. And it shows a range of work. I think, you know, people don't come to me because they say there's a Matthew Smythe look, there is and there isn't. I think the takeaway from looking at my book and seeing the different types of interiors that I work on is maybe a sense of appropriateness and quality. And that's what I want people to see, especially when, you know, if always with my portfolio, I would explain to a potential client that you may not see something directly there that you want to live with, but you can see that I can do it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm hoping that people would see with this book. But Yeah, so there's a range of work here, and it ends with my house. My house is on the cover, and it ends with my house, and which is a very different project than the last book. Also had my house on the cover, but it's a very different house. It's a very different experience. And
let's talk about that, because you moved from a splendid 19th century federal style house just off the green in Sharon, Connecticut, and you became fascinated with a 1970s prefab one story on a rather distressed and tired property in Salisbury.
Oh yeah.
Walk us through that. And what was the first time you walked into that house and said, holy gosh, can I do something with this or what?
Well, it was very strange. You know, I'm always, no matter where I go, I always have to look at real estate. And even though I was very happy in Sharon, I had no intentions of moving. I loved the house. And I just thought, you know, but I was curious what's selling, what's on the market. And maybe I'm always looking for a new project. But there was a house that I kept my eye on, and it looked, I could tell it needed everything from the photographs, but at the same time, it had some interesting lines to it. I had no idea where it was because I never really looked that far. And then I remember it was a Saturday afternoon in the fall. And
this is about 6 years ago now, right?
It was 5 years ago. Yeah. And the price dropped a lot, you know. So I was curious. So I called Elise Harney Morris, who had the listing, and I said, what's the scoop? And she said, well, the owner died, and he was very generous. He left the house to his caretakers, and they've been renting it out all these years for the last 15 years, but they haven't had the money to put into it. And, you know, the renters they're getting, they're not crazy about, and they realize this house is at the last edge where that, you know, something has to be done with it. So I went over to see it that morning, and I bought it that afternoon. I just walked in, and I knew I wasn't. Looking back, when I look back at the photographs now, the before pictures, I thought, "What were you thinking?" But at the time, I wasn't anxious. I just knew, okay, I can do it.
What it looked like.
Well, it was a 1970s ranch house, and it had some good lines to it, but there was an old broken jacuzzi, lots of shag carpeting, a lot of wood paneling, not in great shape. The floors had been stained. The roof was leaking. You know, I remember when I had inspected, the inspector came, you know, there's a crack in the bathtub. I thought, well, that should be the least of my problems. You know, that's fine. So, and the grounds were just overgrown. They had not been taken care of. The man who built it, what I liked about it, I felt, I hate that it sounds like new age, like good energy, but it did have it for me. And then I found out the man who built it, everybody loved him. And he was famous around town. And he was obviously very generous because he left it to his caretaker. So I felt that this was a happy house at one time. And he obviously enjoyed it, because from what I hear, he was an airline pilot. And if that shared carpet could talk, but it needed everything. And, so I was fine with it. And I took the viewpoint that I'm very happy where I am, and I'll fix it up, and then I'll make a decision where to go. Either I'll stay put in Sharon or I'll move there. So the first thing I did was I took all the existing walls down, because I needed to see the structure, what was underneath, because it was a very complicated ceiling layout. So I needed to see where the support beams were. So first thing I did before I designed it was take all the sheetrock off inside. And then I just sat there and designed it, sketched it up, and I hired John Hurley to help me with it. And it was a fun process. And then that work started in November, and in March, it was pretty much, it was 80% done. And I said to myself, I'm moving. I'm definitely going here. So I called Elise, and we put my house in Sharon on the market the week of trade secrets. And it sold 2 weeks later, and I was in here. That August, everything happened really fast.
The transformation is really quite remarkable. I mean, I guess in place of the hot tub, you've got this splendid master suite and bathroom. But I think the most incredible transformation is how you took basically a really obvious two-car garage and turned it into a splendid personal studio. And the thing that strikes me as most inventive about that is that I've never seen a two-car garage so thoroughly transformed into something that will never again make it look like a two-car garage.
You would never.
Every other place I've been to, people who've taken a garage and done it over, it still looks like a two-car garage. How did you do that?
Well, Well, that was the challenge, and it was about keeping the materials the same as the rest of the house and keeping that flow going. I only have two colors in the house. I have that off-white color and the charcoal bronze color, but there's only two colors, so everything sort of connects. And there was also another garage on the property that he kept for his boats, and so that's my garage now, technically. But it was a challenge that I wanted. Having grown up in upstate New York in the 70s, I was very familiar with the ranch house style, and I thought one of these days I want to take the challenge, the ranch house challenge, and see what I can do with it. And that's why I was attracted to this house in the first place, and that's why I was so eager to see it that day. And so I took the challenge. It worked. There were times I didn't realize that how many people were so polite when they came to see it before, who told me later, "We thought you were absolutely lost your mind."
In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer, and my guest today is Matthew Patrick Smythe, one of the country's leading interior designers, whose new book, Through a Designer's Eye, that publishes September 15th, features, among other the residences that he's worked on, his own, which is a transformation of a 1970s prefab in a wooded area with a great setting in Salisbury, Connecticut. This is an off-the-wall question that doesn't have anything to do necessarily with the book, but how do you, because you visit so many houses, people who are your clients or not, how do you not take a busman's holiday? Is it possible for you to walk into a space, private or public, and react to it positively or negatively? And yes, think about what you would do with it instead?
You know, if I'm not asked what to do with it, I don't think about what to do with it.
Good. How did you train yourself to do that? Because I would think that the instinct would be to think about what you would do with it.
No, but maybe it comes back to theater design and frustrated theater design. I'm always fascinated how people live in their houses and who they are and what they choose to live with. So it's not for me to judge. They shouldn't have that if that's what they like. I'm happy when people are happy in their homes. I don't care, where the furniture came from or, the pedigree of anything, as long as they love it and they're enjoying it, who am I to say? If they hire me, then I can come up with some opinions, but without that, no, I can turn it off. I can enjoy it from their perspective, because I think when I walk into a room, I can always see a room five different ways and depending on the clientele. So for me, it's about the person who lives there. So when I go to somebody's house, If they're comfortable there and they're surrounded by things they love, then that's all we can ask for.
How do you navigate, though, the personalities of different clients? Not in terms of what their personality is like, but how do you navigate, let's say, for example, someone who's very prescriptive and tries to tell you exactly what they want, and then on the other end, someone who has no idea whatsoever of even what pleases them?
Well, the person who doesn't know what they want usually does know what they don't want.
Okay.
I sometimes take it from that angle, and if I show them some things, it's easier for people to say I don't like that than to say I like that, because saying you like it is putting you on the line for something and you might not be sure you should like it. So I don't like to put anybody on the spot like that of somebody who's not quite sure, but I can easily. Having done it for so long, if somebody just tells me what they don't like, I can start putting the pieces together from that. As far as somebody wants to tell me what to do after, it doesn't happen a lot, but I have said to clients, I say it once, I say it twice, and the third time you're going to have whatever you want. So it's your call.
Yeah.
Use me or don't use me. But, I'm going to say it twice. And sometimes I can see their face like, okay, what number am I on? But
we talked about your very strong social media presence through your photography on Instagram and on your Instagram page. And I recall when you published your first book, now almost 10 years ago, you had a really, really vigorous national book signing tour that you embarked on. How are you going to market this book when people generally aren't flying around the country and people generally are not standing in line elbow to elbow to get authors' book signs in enclosed spaces in tidy little bookstores?
Well, in February, I was totally booked up for the rest of the year. I had book signings from Louisiana to Los Angeles, San Francisco, everything was set up, Atlanta, Boston, Chicago. But that's all out the window now. So the whole challenge is, luckily for me, my book is coming out now as opposed to the books that came out in April, where everybody was caught off guard and nobody knew what to do. Everything was just canceled and nobody knew, you know, it was hard to, and the offices were closed and nobody was working. But now everybody's back. There's a lot of more creative thinking. I'm doing a lot of Zoom interviews. I've done a couple of live Instagram chats with Schumacher recently. I have an hour-long chat with them. But you know, the main thing that happened since the last time my book came out, well, two things have happened. When my first book came out, not only did I have a lot of book signings and going to, but we also had a lot of bookstores. And we don't have that now. So a lot of the stores I sent books in years ago don't even exist now. So that's changed the industry. And I think then Instagram popped up. And Instagram, you know, we'll see what the power of Instagram is. So far, so good. And it reaches so many more people than I could reach the first time around. Mm-hmm. So between that, I'm still doing, for Atlanta Design Center, I'm doing an interview and talking about the book at the end of the month. I'm doing something with Connecticut Cottages and Gardens at the end of the month also. For the California Decorative Arts Society, I'm doing a Zoom interview in December, and then there'll be book signings connected with that. And as people ask me to do book signings, I'll do them. If it's, you know, if they can pull it off, it's great. I'm game, but it is different. It's going to be very different. I was going to see how, you know, we just have to be a little more creative, and I have to get out of myself and push my book, which, you know, is always feels a little weird, but it's my job now.
Let's talk about the pandemic. It's changing everybody's all aspects of everybody's life. How is it going to change the way people create homes, create their own personal spaces?
Well, I think the
how
market
does design react to that.
Well, I think for the design industry, it's going to be pretty good. I think there's a lot of people have stayed home in their homes, and the ones who have put off doing things. I can't tell you how many people said, I need to reupholster everything. I've got red wine over all the furniture. you know, everybody's tired of where they are. Even, you know, so anybody who's thinking about, who was putting it off for a long time now wants to get back on track with this and get it done. I do think that, and also I think for, you know, you talked about people who want to control everything. I think people, there will be a lot more people who are going to respect interior designer as a profession, because the main luxury we have in life is time. And why not hire somebody who can do something for you and give you more free time to be with your family and do what you want? And I think interior designers are going to be, especially for young, I tell young designers to hang in there. It's going to be fine for them. And so, I mean, the home is going to be, we've always talked about the home being important, but it wasn't because there was still, everybody was still running. Kids were running off to school. People were taking trips. Everybody's hopping on a plane. That hasn't happened. It'll get back to that eventually, but I think it'll be at a slower pace. And I do think that there'll be more concentration on making the home work, not only just for family, but for working. So, because so many people, even if they do go back to the office, back to the office, there'll still be moments where they have to work from home, because that'll change. The way our attitude towards working at home has changed. It's not a luxury anymore.
As we get near the end of this program, I wanted to comment on the end of your book, which is, I think, in some ways the most unexpected and also the most charming part of the book, and it's headlined Giving Back, and it has the most unexpected pictures of the most unexpected room we don't associate with Matthew Patrick Smythe. Tell us about it and what Giving Back really means.
Well, I'm glad you like that, because I didn't fight for it. We didn't have to fight very hard. They gave in fast, but everybody said, "Oh no, that picture's going to break the mood." I said, "No, it's going to just top it all off." 4 or 5 years ago, I was asked by Anthony Barada, a fellow interior designer, to get involved with the Ronald McDonald House in Long Island. He had done it about 20 years before, and it was time for a redo. So he thought of asking designers to take spaces. So I went out there. Bunny Williams did a beautiful lobby and reading room, and a lot of designers, Jamie Jay, got involved. And so we had to go out and pick out our rooms. And I saw one room, and we had to do choice 1, 2, and 3. And I put down Mets room, Mets room, Mets room. And there was
Mets.
A tire.
Like the Mets. Like the baseball.
New York Mets. Dang. Yeah, the owner of the Mets was on the board of the hospital. So there was a Mets room, but it was bad. It was just decals on the wall, bad Barca lounger furniture, nothing. So I said, I just thought to myself, if you've done every other kind of room, you've never done a New York Mets room, this is your challenge. So I took it on. I had great fun with it. And also the best thing about the room was that in a local story, I needed a carpet and I needed orange and blue. Like Yankees colors are easy, Mets is hard, that orange and blue combination. So I couldn't find it in New York. So I go to Ron Lagle in Canaan. So I said to Ron, I need an orange blue carpet. So he's pulling out all these books and I'm getting like rashes from the books. And he finally says to me, what do you want it for? And I said, because I'm doing a New York Mets room. Now I also backtrack. I've been working with the marketing department of the Mets who had no help at all. So they didn't know what anything other. So he said, why don't you use the Mets carpet? So what are you talking about? And he pulls out this book and there was a carpet company that made all the carpets for all the teams. And that made the room. That really, it would have been a fine, good room, but Ron Lagle saved the day. And I talk about him in my book.
Yeah. Finally, the book is published September 15th, available through whatever your online ordering site is, as well as local bookstores and very locally. The book will be available at Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, and you've kindly agreed to make personalized signed copies available through Johnny Cake Books.
Yeah. Starting. If anyone wants to give her a gift, just leave word with Dan. I'll write anything inside.
Great. Matthew, congratulations on the book. It's really splendid. And all the best with it. And thank you for joining us on Off Script.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. Until you tune in the next time, wear your mask, wash your hands, keep a safe distance, and everybody be nice to each other, take care of each other. Thanks for listening.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.